Welcome to Out of Bounds. I'm Tish Perlman. My guest is Carla Kaplan. Kaplan is the Davis Distinguished Professor of American Literature at Northeastern University. Her books include The Erotics of Talk and Zora Neale Hurston, A Life in Letters. Her most recent and the focus of our interview is the highly acclaimed Miss Anne in Harlem, The White Women of the Black Renaissance, and it was published in September by Harper. I'm talking to Carla Kaplan by phone from her office in Massachusetts. Carla Kaplan, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me today.
I'd like to begin with the title of your book, Miss Anne in Harlem. Miss Anne was a derogatory collective term for white women who got involved with the cultural and political movements in Harlem. Tell us where that term came from.
Well, it was certainly a term that I think was applied to women if they attempted to become part of the Harlem Renaissance. And one of the reasons I use the term in the title for the book is a way to signal to the reader that in telling the story of this small group of white women who were not just being tourists in Harlem, but were really trying to put Black Harlem at the center of their lives, I'm looking at them through a number of different lenses. So I'm attempting to look at them from their own experience and to ask them to explain in their voices, as much as a biographer can, what it was they were trying to do in crossing that uncrossable race line, why they were there, and what it was like. But I'm also looking at them from the perspective of Black Harlem. And Black Harlem's response was, oh no, here's Miss Anne in Harlem. This is not what we need. Oi, what are we going to do here? And the phrase is really a general term for any white woman. It's a dismissive term for white women that, as far as we can tell, predates the Harlem Renaissance and was probably coined by Black Southern female domestic workers who were stuck in the kitchens of white women for 12, 15, 17, 19 hours a day and could never afford, without losing their jobs, to disrespect or dismiss those white female employers to their faces. But behind their backs, they could refer to them collectively and derisively as Miss Anne.
Wow.
And the other reason I use the term is that in the course of doing the book, it became very clear to me that this was a term with immediate recognition in Black communities and in Black communities north and south, east and west. It's a term that evokes a kind of a knowing laugh in Black communities. But it's a term that, until my book came out anyway, would draw blankness from white response, you know, from in a white community. People would say, Miss who? Miss what? Mm-hmm. And that reminded me that we still live in different and often divided worlds where
Absolutely.
A phrase like Miss Anne can be meaningful in a Black community in a very layered way, but be meaningless in a white community.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
And that seemed important to me.
Let's talk about the scene, though. You know, a lot of folks think about the Roaring Twenties as this breezy, carefree jazz era, but it really was an ugly time with lynchings and the rise of the Klan. It set the scene for us.
And I'm so glad that you started with that, because one of the reasons to go back to these women's stories and to rethink this era is to enrich our understanding of the 1920s as not just a period in which all of the great taboos are falling by the wayside, and some were, certainly.
Mm-hmm.
Hemlines were rising and more people were talking about sex. But in many ways, this was one of the most rigid periods of American history, particularly when it came to race and ethnicity. This is the period of the 1920s when the nation is drawing some of the most restrictive immigration quotas ever drawn before or since in national history, including complete exclusion of Chinese immigrants. And it's the period, as you mentioned, in which we see this really alarming rise in racial violence sparked by the Ku Klux Klan and other like-minded organizations, and lynchings go up just in a very pronounced way in every year of the 1920s. So this is a period in which the racial line and racial segregation is being policed in a very violent way throughout American culture. So when we have an image of the 1920s as a freewheeling time, we need to remember that it was not freewheeling for many people. It
Absolutely.
Was not freewheeling for working people or for American immigrants. Americans, and it was certainly not freewheeling for African Americans or any whites who wanted in a serious way to cross the racial line.
Absolutely, and I'm so glad you wrote this book because people need to hear this history. Now, one of the many fascinating women that you discuss is Josephine Cogdell Schuyler. She was from a well-to-do Texas family. Tell us a little bit about her. She married a very famous black man.
She did, and she was from a well-to-do, and I want to add, because I think it's important to what happens to her later in her life, racist Texas family.
Mm-hmm.
Her father was a charter member of the Ku Klux Klan. She referred to all of her brothers as racist. She came from a community she considered just mired in the worst kind of backward racial ideology. And she was someone who was always very strong-minded, even as a child. She wanted to get out of there. She wanted a broader and a bigger life for herself. So her first move was to become a new woman, and like many new women, particularly from the South and the West, she ran away to Greenwich Village, did not find it terribly satisfying. She actually started first in San Francisco, then Greenwich Village, and then gravitated quickly to Harlem, where she met and fell in love with George Schuyler, the most important African-American journalist of the day, and they began a love affair, and they got married at a point at which, while not illegal in New York, she was so concerned about the disapproval she knew she would face for an interracial marriage that she lied on her marriage certificate and wrote down colored because she just couldn't deal with what she was sure the clerk would say if she wrote down white.
Yeah, and this was in 1928, correct?
Yes, and they had a really remarkable life. They were very much at the center of Harlem politics and culture. Josephine had clearly hoped that she would be embraced by the black community in a way that never quite happened.
Mm-hmm.
She experienced a certain amount of social isolation and loneliness. She never told most of her Texas family about either her husband or her daughter. So she kept her family a secret from her family of origin, which meant that really she had very little to do with her Texas family after that.
Mm-hmm.
And while her family was very famous, they were written about in all of the magazines and journals of the day, referred to consistently as America's strangest family.
Yes.
And she was a celebrity. They were referred to as one of America's interracial celebrity marriages. And they really courted that publicity. Their daughter, Philippa, it's very convenient for them, but she turned out to be a genius.
Mm-hmm.
And as soon as they realized, which they realized very early on, that Philippa was a genius, they began to exhibit her. She became Exhibit A. And Josephine and George used Philippa to prove that biracial children were not inferior, but in their estimation were actually superior to children who only came from one race.
Mm-hmm.
Because of Philippa and because of George's fame as a writer, because of Josephine's really odd ideas about diet and child rearing, the family became quite famous. So they were in the public eye, and yet Josephine was often very lonely. And she dealt with that by inventing a number of personae for herself. She wrote under at least half a dozen pseudonyms, probably more.
That fascinated me. She wrote it in an advice column as a black woman, right?
Exactly. And I find that so moving. I think she had really hoped and probably expected that she would be accepted by black women and be part of their circle. And she was accepted by some. Indeed, the really well-known African-American woman activist, Ella Baker, was one of her dearest friends, was there for Philippa's birth. But she had a difficult time. So she created in her writing life the centrality to black women's culture that she wanted for herself. She invented this persona named Julia Jerome. Julia Jerome was the black Ann Landers of her day.
Mm-hmm.
She was known throughout the nation, and she was the woman to whom other black women wrote for advice about their boyfriends, their brothers, their fathers, their husbands, raising their children, dealing with other people. And as Julia Jerome, she was able to be at the center of the conversation that black women were having across the nation. Of course, now she was passing as a black woman. People mm-hmm. did not know that black Julia Jerome was actually white Josephine Cogdell Schuyler.
That is the most remarkable story.
Isn't it amazing?
I was amazed.
It gave her a certain satisfaction that I think she was seeking, but it was also, I'm sure, very poignant, because the fact that she had to pass to achieve that must have always been a reminder to her of what she couldn't have in daily life.
Yeah, yeah. You know, the stream running through this remarkable book that you've given us is there was so much discussion, especially among the Miss Anns, quote, quote, to suggest that race was a fiction and there really was no such thing as race. Talk to us a little bit about that.
I was so surprised as I went deeper and deeper into the lives and the thinking of the women I chose to tell full biographies of in this book, at how canny many of them were and how sophisticated they were in getting in on these debates that were part of the 1920s. We tend to talk today as if we invented the notion that identity is a social construction, as if we invented the argument that there's no such thing as an identity that is really based in our blood mm-hmm. or somehow essential to our core, but that identity is something we create and we construct. Well, this was very much one of the ideas at the heart of race debates in the 1920s. The Harlem Renaissance period is the period in Harlem, but in other cities as well in the nation, in which blacks are very much debating the question of how to, on the one hand, celebrate blackness, because fomenting black pride was crucial to black political organizing, at the same time as they could contest this biological notion of black identity, which had been fundamental to American racism, which was founded, after all, on the one-drop rule,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
sometimes referred to in academic writing as the rule of hypodescent. And that's the rule that said that if you had one drop of black blood, you are black,
yeah,
and therefore not entitled to any of the civic privileges of whiteness. But that was also based in the idea that somehow racial identity could be measured by drops of blood. So I went back to a very old notion that race was in the blood, and people at this time were very involved in contesting that idea as crazy, right? Who has the beaker, and how do you measure this? Who's dripping out? How do you measure? Because blood is blood. Blood is red. Right? Blood
right,
isn't
right.
black or white. So how are you measuring this? And the women I write about were getting involved in that debate in a very interesting way.
Mm-hmm.
Because many of them were saying, okay, so you're saying race isn't in the blood. That identity, it could be a matter of allegiance or affiliation or advocacy. Okay, I volunteer for blackness. Sign me up. I'm one too. And of course, Black Harlem says, whoa, that's not quite what we meant. And some of them, like Nancy Cunard, are canny enough to say, all right, why not? If I can't claim to be black based on how I feel and based on my sense of allegiance, what's your answer to that? Why can't I? Is it because you really do believe that race is in the blood? So they were part, in a very interesting way, of taking an important argument and pushing it to extremes.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Carla Kaplan. She's the author of Miss Anne in Harlem, The White Women of the Black Renaissance. And Carla, this is such a fascinating book. Tell us a little bit, and I didn't even know this one, Mary White Ovington.
Yes, Mary
socialist.
White Ovington, and you know, you must not fault yourself. I don't think very many people at all know that the NAACP has as its white founder this woman, Mary White Ovington, born
surprised.
Into Brooklyn Heights.
A surprising fact.
I think this is one of the little-known factoids of the book. And the book is peppered with a number of, I think, little-known factoids like that.
Mm-hmm.
Mary White Ovington went to great lengths to draw no attention or as little attention as she could to her own role in black racial advancement. On the one hand, she moved from Brooklyn Heights and away from settlement work into working with black and into working in Black Harlem because she was determined to make her mark. She was a woman who looked at what it meant to be an upper-class white woman of her milieu, did not want a life of dinner parties and whist and calling cards. And she said, I have to find a larger sphere for my activity. And becoming a black civil an activist in black civil rights organizations gave her that. At the same time, she was a woman who was keenly sensitive to the very difficult history of the role white women had played in American racial relations, which is to say, used as an excuse for centuries for violence enacted against black, specifically black men, white women's supposed fragility and vulnerability used as an excuse to lynch black men for centuries, and a failure, for the most part, for centuries on the part of white women to stand up and say, we refuse this notion, don't use us in this way, there's no truth to this myth, we refuse to be complicit in this violence. So she felt, as a white woman, that the only way she could do good work in a black community was to fly under the radar, to draw very little attention to herself, and to be hyper-conscious of not letting the spotlight be on her.
Yeah, that's a remarkable story for me. You know, the stigma running through both the culture and the press during this time was that white women only hung around black men because of sex. I mean, that was the notion.
Yes. And this goes in a number of directions. It was a way of controlling white women's behavior, because since the taboos around sexual, being sexual, you know, not respectable, not were so strong for white women that anything that created that taint was a good way to control them. And it also went back to very fundamental notions of racial identity. Again, back to the one drop rule, which was always sexualized. The notion that this is a period, people have to remember, where blackness is understood in the main, in American culture, as a pollutant and a contagion. And it's understood very differently for white men and for white women. The idea is that it's a pollutant and a contagion. These drops are pollutants and contagions, right? These drops of black blood. But white men are relatively safe from them. So they can expose themselves in a limited way to blackness without being harmed. And they're encouraged in the 1920s to expose themselves in an almost medicinal way. That if they have limited exposure to blackness, it will invigorate their masculinity. Again, blackness is already in that idea somehow seen as sexual.
God, isn't it amazing?
But white women are warned that if they expose themselves to blackness, it will contaminate or pollute them, almost inseminate them, and they will lose their whiteness. And this notion is so deep in American culture that Mary White Ovington, who lived the most careful of lives, she, you know, didn't want any bad publicity. She was as matronly could get. As far as we can tell, one of the costs of her political activity and her notion of how she had to present herself in public was that she had no sexual intimate life. She just became chaste, and she put that part of her life away. So the press couldn't really sexualize Ovington, particularly at the point in the Harlem Renaissance. She's already matronly and an older woman. So what did the press do? It said that Mary White Ovington was sponsoring interracial debates and discussions to procure black male lovers for young white women. That's how determined the press was to sexualize any white woman who became involved in black culture.
Yeah.
And that's how far it went, right?
Another thread that runs through your book is the fact that these women were living through a very sexist time, too. I mean, feminism needed to come out and save some of these women, too. You know?
And, you know, the kind of feminism they were looking for just either wasn't there or it wasn't working for them. So it's really, it is a book about two generations of women. And the older generation of women, Mary White Ovington, Charlotte Osgood Mason,
Annie
Nathan
Meyer. Yeah, I want to talk
about
Charlotte Osgood Mason, too, yeah.
Oh, she's such a trip. She's so weird. All of these older women, they're seeking a much bigger sphere for themselves than they would have been allowed under the available script for women in their day.
Absolutely.
And they're not interested in being new women.
Yeah.
They think the new women movement is frivolous, courts the wrong kind of publicity, is way too concerned with fashion and sexuality, that it's too concerned with small symbolic victories. They're not interested.
Mm-hmm.
So that's not working for them, and they don't have an alternative feminist movement that really speaks to them. Any Nathan Meyer, in fact, becomes a kind of virulent anti-suffrage advocate. In fact, she describes herself as the most famous of the antis, mostly to distinguish herself from her sister Maud, who's one of the most famous suffrage workers in the nation. So suffrage isn't speaking to many of them. So
that's
they
right,
move
yeah.
into a different sphere.
Yeah.
The women who start as sort of classic new women like Josephine Cogdell Schuyler and Nancy Cunard actually develop a pretty strong critique of those movements as insufficiently political and as too inward looking, too interested in individual advancement, and not think they want feminists to reach outside gender issues towards class and race, and they see too many of the new women as having a narrow vision. So one of the things that backgrounds the way in which each of these women come to Harlem, and they all come for different reasons, with different motives and with different outcomes, but their reactions to available modes and models of women's rebellion are key to the reasons each of them move into Black culture.
That's right. That's right. And this is still a debate that goes on today in feminist circles and in women's studies programs. Before we run out of time, I do want to have you talk about Charlotte Osgood Mason. Fascinating, powerful patron, famous Black writers she took under her wing like Langston
yes.
Hughes. Talk to us a little bit about her.
Now, Charlotte Osgood Mason was someone I didn't think I was going to be able to include in this book.
Mm.
Charlotte Osgood Mason has always been considered one of the great mysteries of the Harlem Renaissance, and very little has been known about Charlotte Osgood Mason. We knew that she gave enormous amounts of money to the Harlem Renaissance, and we knew that she was the very imperious patron of, as you say, Hurston, Hughes, Locke, Covarrubias, and many others. We also knew that she was someone who saw herself as having a great deal of psychic power, and that her patrons described her as exerting a great deal of psychic influence and power over them. And beyond that, she was kind of a mystery because it seemed that she was someone who was very much a primitivist, who came to Harlem with her own narrow ideas that what Blackness could do is heal white culture, that white culture was washed out, arid, failing, and that it needed to be invigorated by a particular notion of Blackness, which was associated by primitivists like Mason with Africa. And the mystery was how this imperious Park Avenue woman with these primitivist ideas was able to control all of these Black intellectuals who must have been absolutely chafing under her tyrannical control. Well, the story gets even weirder.
God, it's a fascinating story.
Part of what I was able to uncover is they were not chafing. In fact, for years, all of these key intellectuals of the Harlem Renaissance genuinely adored this woman.
And she they had to call her godmother, right?
They had to call her godmother, but during the first years of their relationship with her, they didn't mind in the least. She seemed like a godmother. And Hurston, Hughes, and Locke absolutely adored her. Locke never stopped adoring her. After she died, the people who handled Mason's estate gave to Locke a number of pieces of African art from Mason's collection, letting him believe she had willed those to him because they didn't want to break his heart, and she ignored him in her will, and he still loved her so much in the mid-1940s that they felt they had to engage in this charade so that he wouldn't be devastated. That's how much he remained devoted to her. It took Hurston years to break with Mason, and in a way, Hughes never did.
Yeah.
Mason broke with Hughes. It broke Hughes's heart in a way that he never entirely recovered from.
Yeah, you talk about that. Wow.
Yeah, so part of the mystery that I had to unpack, first I had to find out if anything could be really known about her and why it had proved so hard to research her. And then the question was why these brilliant, brilliant intellectuals and artists of the Harlem Renaissance, what they saw in this woman.
Mm-hmm.
And It's really a story about how limited most interracial relations were. So that someone who came, even with the kind of restricted ideas about blackness she represented, the fact that she loved blackness and didn't love whiteness was almost enough for her to win the hearts and minds of Harlem. Mm-hmm. Because there were so few white people who came to Harlem in love in that way with blackness and not in love with whiteness.
Yeah, but it seems to me that she pretty much bought and manipulated these people because she had money.
There's no question that she used her money in an incredibly manipulative way.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, it was important to me to recognize that she was dealing with people who themselves were enormously sophisticated. So she used her money in an extremely manipulative way, but you couldn't just buy Locke, Hurston, or Hughes. They mm-hmm. were too smart for that.
Mm-hmm.
So that was the complication of all of this. What else did she offer them beyond the money that allowed them to become so intimate with her? Because these were people who actually couldn't be bought.
Yeah.
And that's what made her story so fascinating and, frankly, so odd.
Yeah, it was. The
closer you look, the more it appears that she really did have a very deep psychological, in their own words, psychic connection to these patrons. They achieved a kind of interracial bond, even with all of the primitivism and racism and tyranny that was part of that relationship.
Absolutely.
Nonetheless, the bond they also achieved with her was symbolically important for them.
Yeah. Carla, we're almost out of time. Can you just say in a few sentences what were some of the surprises that you unearthed while you were researching this book?
There were many. One of the surprises I unearthed was finding out that a number of people we thought either were black or were white, that they were not who we thought. So mm-hmm. finding out, for example, that Julia Jerome was white, Josephine Cogdell Schuyler, and indeed that Josephine wrote under many pseudonyms and did some of her black husband's writing for him. There's almost, it seems very clear that that happened. In fact, it's almost impossible that it didn't, if you know what was going on in George's life. Finding out that Lillian Wood, a writer who we have always thought was a black writer, was indeed a white writer. Those were some of the surprises.
Mm-hmm.
But beyond that, the surprises that kept me going for years as I spent time with these women's lives were how determined they were not just to try to be accepted in black Harlem, but to try to take responsibility for whiteness. That each of these women, even with all of their bumbling and their failures and their condescensions, they were often patronizing, they were often condescending, none of them managed to escape their own backgrounds. And that's an important piece of their story. They tried to do a very pioneering anti-racist thing, but they carried their own racism with them as they did it.
Yes, Carla, we're out of time. Thank you so much for joining us. Again, my guest was Carla Kaplan. Her book is called Miss Anne in Harlem, The White Women of the Black Renaissance. Thank you so much, Carla.
Thank you so much for having me.
Our audio producer is Nate Richardson at Rep Studio in Ithaca, New York. Our theme music was composed by Diego Vega. And we are a sponsored project of the New York Foundation for the Arts. Tax-deductible donations are welcome at artspire.org. That's artspire.org. And visit us online at outofboundsradioshow.com. I'm Tish Perlman. We'll be back next week.